Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 14th September 2018, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. Your host today, Mike Robinson, myself, Brian Gerrish. We're delighted to have David Scott with us. David, of course, presenting Northern Exposure, matters north of the border. Well, we need to start with the really critical news, Mike, I think, and hopefully David will have a few words on this.
So the headline, David, from the Scotsman is, "I was bullied at school," admits First Minister Nicola Sturgeon. So this is vital news as we are heading towards war with Russia.
This is part of an ongoing campaign called Operation Human Being. This is the internal phrase for it within Scottish nationalism. And it's meant to soften the image of Nicola Sturgeon and make her seem less like a one-dimensional political functionary and more like a normal human being that people can relate to. So this has promoted many changes in her life, and here she's revealing that not only she experienced something unpleasant at primary school, it doesn't really go into what, but she wants to become a children's author when she's no longer First Minister, and appear on Dancing on Ice.
David, yeah. these are clearly just allegations at this stage. Has she produced any evidence to back up her claims that she was bullied at school?
No, but you might be interested to know she doesn't like dogs, and that's never a good sign.
Okay. Well, let's move on to slightly more serious stuff then. And of course, RT had an interview with the two so-called suspects in the Skripal poisoning. Here they are on screen at the moment. Well, they've published the entire unedited interview. And so you can see the course of the conversation without any breaks or suspicion that stuff has been added or removed. What can we say about this, Brian? My view is that there's nothing much that these two say during this interview which really stacks up. Almost as many holes in what they're saying as there are in Theresa May's narrative for what happened on this side of the channel.
It is a tricky one, Mike, on this. My take on it early this morning, walking my dog, I'm sorry, Nippy will be upset with that, but walking my dog and just thinking about this a bit, was that the Russians got to the stage of absolutely taking the mickey out of Theresa May and British intelligence. We're going to come on to British intelligence in a moment. I think the Russians have got to the point where they regard the whole thing as so crass, they just thought they'd let this run. But maybe that's not the case. David, what do you think of these two handsome young men?
I don't know what to make of them. I mean, there doesn't seem to be anything clear. There doesn't seem to be any evidence against them. It's very strange. I've been reading here in the Press and Journal, amongst 287 articles that have the word Novichok in it, in the Aberdeen's Press and Journal. So that gives you an idea how much this story has been penetrating the mainstream media, that they are repeating that they are members of Russian military intelligence, quote. But what we don't seem to have is evidence. So would someone please give me some evidence of something? Other than where they were in Salisbury once, and they're Russian, is that all we actually have to go on?
Well, what do we know about them? We know that they claim that they're not GRU. They were eventually pressed on what they do for a living, because they had said at the beginning of the interview that they were visiting as tourists. That they were not on business this time. Well, this implies that they come to the UK on business from time to time, although they didn't say that specifically. But when they were pressed what they did do, they said that they were working in the fitness industry. So
supplements.
Indeed. So yeah. So what are they? Why are they coming to the UK on business? I don't know. As you say, really, no evidence whatsoever. We'll come on to that a little bit more in a second. But before we do that, Brian, there was the small matter of the interview with, well, the interviewer that interviewed these two the head of RT effectively, was then interviewed by BBC Newsnight by Kirsty Wark. I thought we should have a look at this because I want to comment on the interview itself.
Having worked as a reporter for almost 20 years now, I only believe, oh, for more than 20 years now, I only believe what I see with my own eyes. I saw with my own eyes that they do look completely like the people on the video that was released by the British police. So for that matter, I do believe they are those people. But as far as the story goes, I don't have any reasons to believe them. I don't know them. I haven't spent life with them. They're not my friends. But I have no more reasons to believe Secret Services who have been lying previously.
Doesn't the manner of this interview you concern you, and the fact that it doesn't it just reinforce the idea that RT is a propaganda tool for the Russian state?
You did watch the interview, didn't you?
Oh, I watched the interview.
Did you see my face? Did you see the tone? You probably don't speak Russian.
I don't speak Russian, but I also looked at the transcript.
Yeah. And the questions were quite obviously hard for them and made them nervous. And at some point, they even said something like, "We came here, we thought you would support us. And you behave like we were at the investigation in a court." And I said, "Well, I'm not here to support you. I'm not your advocate. I'm a journalist. I don't know why you would say that. Your question seems completely unobjective to me right now. Your question to me seems like a typical Western propaganda because of which people actually watch RT.
And one last point.
Nothing like what you're saying it was. Nothing like.
One
Thank
last question. One last question. You actually looked at the footage of the two men in... Margarita Simeon, are you still there? I think she's gone.
And indeed she had.
She had. I just want to say before there's any more comment, I'm fascinated by the setting for that interview. The studio is darkened. It's back. Maybe the studio's like that all the time. But to me, this is BBC theatre around this very interview itself when you see the woman on screen.
Perhaps and... I'm almost speechless, really.
Yeah,
it's getting harder to comment on this. But the BBC, bearing in mind, David, everything that it's doing at the moment, the BBC dares to suggest that any other broadcaster is state-influenced. It's the hypocrisy, the arrogance, the... Okay, well, it's just unbelievable, David.
Well, it's very interesting because we see it cropping up. There's a particular phrase, and I've been picking this up in the Scottish press, and it's always the same words. These words, no other words. What's that channel called? Kremlin-backed RT, right? That phrase keeps coming up. It's almost like there's been an instruction that is what we are going to call it. The Glasgow Herald calls it that, right? It crops up in papers all across Scotland, all across Britain. It's not just on the BBC. Everyone suddenly calls it Kremlin-backed RT. So what does that mean? We have to start calling the BBC Whitehall-backed BBC? Is that the equivalent? Or is it Westminster-backed BBC? I'm not quite sure what we should call it, but clearly we need to have a line. And then you look at the programmes, right? And the striking thing when you look at the difference between BBC and RT, firstly, RT doesn't come and try to take my money in order to watch the product, right? So that's one difference. And secondly, on RT, there's a variety of voices. You can hear people you'll agree with, you can hear people you don't agree with. You'll have libertarians, you'll have hard lefties, you'll have all sorts of a spread of opinion, right? And on the BBC, there's one tone, with a tiny variation allowed, and it's very, very tightly controlled. And then the other thing is when people are coming on to speak on RT, what happens is the RT phone them up 15 minutes before they're due on air, and then they go live. They don't discuss with them what they're going to say. There's no editorial control, because once these people are on air, they say whatever they want, and the scope is there to say anything they want. And a large variety of voices are then constantly invited back. So this narrative, I mean, of course, there's bias. You know, there's bias everywhere. But the idea that the bias is is in RT and not in the BBC is just ridiculous.
Absolutely. Well, look, let's move on then, because RT, strangely enough, had Neil Clark on. And, you know, he was discussing the interview with these two so-called suspects, making the points about the fact that, you know, there was plenty to ask them, plenty of additional questions to ask them, but that the British narrative is still full of holes. And he made this point. Of course, the biggest question we ought to be asking is, if it is the case that these two suspects arrive in Salisbury at 11:48 a.m. and the Scripples left their home at 9:15 a.m., how was it that they were poisoned on the door handle of their home? Because we have no evidence that they actually returned home. Well, this is one of the many unanswered questions on the sort of narrative that Theresa May is presenting. And apparently British journalism doesn't want to ask these questions, doesn't want to investigate, aside from the fact that the British government doesn't want to answer. The mainstream media in this country isn't saying, and we asked this question, and the BBC, and the British government, it's hard to tell the difference, didn't want to answer. So, you know, again, this is a viewpoint. Neil Clark's viewpoint is a viewpoint, as you say, David, that we would not have heard from the BBC, and we're not hearing from any other mainstream corporate media outlet in the UK.
Yeah, the issue that I'm seeing in the UK is the story coming from the press. It's not entirely controlled, but it's becoming much more one note. And you're seeing more and more of the mainstream press align behind a particular narrative. Even things like The Guardian, which is just an anti-British left-wing propaganda rag now, and The Telegraph, which is, I'm not even quite sure how to describe The Telegraph. But on certain things, they'll align, and they're actually indistinguishable one from another. So there's clearly some degree of increasing control over press output. Now, there's still people who are putting out different viewpoints. Spiked is one standard bearer for having a different view and putting it forward consistently. But this is getting less and less. And if you look at all the mainstream press, there seems to be a monotonous uniformity developing.
Well, look, let's leave this subject then with this article. This is from The Telegraph. Is bucolic Salisbury witnessing a spike in Russian visitors? Because, of course, one of the things that the RT interviewer found so difficult was the suggestion that these two were wanting to go as tourists to Salisbury. Why the hell would you want to go to Salisbury? And they said, well, because, you know, it's got a fantastic cathedral with a clock. It's the oldest clock in Europe or something that's still operating, he said. So she was kind of taking the mickey out of the fact they wanted to go and see this clock. But anyway, the Telegraph has produced this article today asking, is there a tourism industry in Salisbury, and are tourists coming from Russia? And it begins off by saying, we trust that Salisbury MP John Glenn's assessment of the holiday cover story used by the Russian pair accused of poisoning Sergei Skripal and his daughter as not credible in any way at all is not because he believes that no one in their right mind would fly thousands of miles for a mini break in the Wiltshire city. Though he'd probably be right not to do a disservice to Salisbury, it's hardly Paris or Tokyo or Dundee. And not only does a whistle-stop tour of it, during which Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Borisov failed to see the cathedral spire they travelled all the way from Moscow for because of the slush, seems like an implausible travel plan, but they didn't even mention Arundel's, the home of former British Prime Minister Ted Heath. What kind of person plans a weekend's itinerary in Salisbury without apportioning a good hour or two to Arundel's? Well, yes, maybe if you have a morbid taste for viewing the home of a traitor and a paedophile, then perhaps you might want to go to Arundel's. But anyway, this is what this the Telegraph thinks that you want to be doing. And it goes on to say, it does admit about halfway down the article, it says, indeed, in 2013, when Wiltshire was celebrating a year of plenty in terms of overseas tourists, the chief executive of Visit Wiltshire, David Andrews, said that Russia was one of the markets the county has been wooing. So there's an acknowledgement that, in fact, Brian, the Visit Wiltshire organisation that promotes tourism in the county was targeting Russia as a market. And so perhaps that's why these two wanted to go.
Yeah. I'm also lost for words over this one, Mike, because at the back of my mind, I still have baby wipes coming up, that whatever this story is about, it's to do with a pretty unpleasant chemical weapon. But not to worry, because you can use baby wipes to solve the problem.
So briefly, David, briefly.
I think the Russians have shown a very good sense of humour here. Now, can you imagine the joy you could find walking into a small shop in Salisbury with a very strong Russian accent and asking for a small sealed container?
Better if they ask for baby wipes, actually, but we'll discuss that after the news today.
Yes.
Well, this headline caught my eye, and I just thought how incredible this one is. The Daily Telegraph, May, Salisbury denial is an insult to our intelligence. And the moment I saw the intelligence there, I thought, yes, British intelligence, and that is exactly what's going on. I think the Russians are taking the mickey now, because this is a pantomime and a charade. And I think what we've got here is the Russians starting to play it. The real insult to the British public is British intelligence. We'll just go through a little bit on this to get a flavour for it. But we're going back here to some statements made by MI6 last year. Jeremy Corbyn is a danger to this nation. At MI6, which I once led, he wouldn't clear the security vetting. So that's a pretty hard statement. At the same time, the Mail got stuck in. Britain's former top spy claims Corbyn's terror links would see him fail the vetting process if he applied to join Britain's security services, but warns if he becomes PM, he will be running those services.
That's Sir Richard Dearlove, same Sir Richard Dearlove that's involved with Pablo Miller and Christopher Steele and the Skripals.
Yeah, that's that sort of person, really.
Right.
So we've suddenly got this outpouring of Britain's intelligence services warning us about people like Corbyn. Can we trust British intelligence? Well, let's just follow through some of the statements. Here's Mr. Dearlove, and this is what he said in more detail. Frankly, I'm shocked that no one has stood up and said unambiguously how profoundly dangerous it would be for the nation if Jeremy Corbyn becomes Prime Minister. That's quite a statement from a civil servant, isn't it? So let me be clear, the leader of the Labour Party is an old-fashioned international socialist who's forged links with those quite ready to use terror when they haven't got their way. The IRA, Hezbollah, Hamas, as a result, he's completely unfit to govern, and Britain would be less safe with him in number 10. And on it goes. I can give an indication of just how serious this is. If Jeremy Corbyn was applying to join any of this country's security services, MI5, GCHQ, or the service I used to run, MI6, he would not be cleared to do so. He would be, what does it say here? He would be rejected by the vetting process. Far from being able to get into MI5 in the past, MI5 would have actively investigated him. And yet this is the man who seeks the very highest office, who hopes in just 24 hours' time to run our security services. So there was part of this I didn't quite understand on the time scale, but we just take the words as printed. So they're absolutely, absolutely hammering here. Move on through this one. And what have we got? Well, we've got MI6 here, of course, labelled as making blunders over weapons of mass destruction. And the Chilcot inquiry, whatever we say about it, it did produce information pointing a finger at MI6 to say we went to war based on information which was fabricated, and MI6 was clearly implicated in the fabrication of that evidence.
But that's all in the past, Brian. It doesn't happen anymore.
Well, I'm bringing it to the surface now, Mike, because the hypocrisy of this man is just unbelievable, pointing a finger at Corbyn and saying Corbyn is a dangerous man, when we've got these people taking us to war, millions have died on the back of their lies. But Corbyn is in the spotlight. Remarkably, a Tory, Brooks Newmark, who boasted that he was on the border with General Idris, who was linked through to Al Nusra, Was this ever investigated by MI5, MI6? I don't hear anybody speaking out about this.
Well, he's probably there on their behalf.
Well, we don't know, but we did have the same MI6, bottom right on screen at the moment, saying the most significant terrorist threat to UK and its interests overseas comes from Al-Qaeda's senior leadership. So what is going on in British intelligence? The stories don't stack up. I think we're looking at street theatre. People are dying, there's no question of that, but lies and obfuscation coming out of these supposedly very important authorities. And that brings us into this. We're going back to October 2017 here, but here's the Telegraph. MI5 knew of the cover-up over the Cyril Smith child abuse. The ICSA inquiry was told. And here's the Shropshire Star. Encourage people to go to this article because it's very detailed. And they say spectre of collusion raised by MI5 dossier on Cyril Smith child abuse claims. So MI5 was told by Sir Thomas Hetherington, then the Department of Public Prosecutions in 1979, that his office falsely told the press that they had no record of a police file of evidence against Cyril Smith. In reality, prosecutors had been given a file in 1970 saying the allegations against Smith made by 8 boys associated with the Cambridge House Hostel in Rochdale stand up but choose not to take him to trial. And we get on to this. Why would the DPP contact MI5 about this at all? This is being discussed in the inquiry. Why was an apparent South African connection suspected? There's also a reference in the covering letter to another child sexual abuse investigation with Cyril Smith by the Met Police in the mid-1970s. Again, why would MI5 hold that information? Why was MI5 involved at all? And the final line there says, we say this dossier from MI5 raises a spectre of collusion. So we are to believe MI5 or MI6 when it's to do with what's happening overseas or dictators. But when it comes to what is really going on in our country, they don't feel the need to do anything. So The Guardian picked up on this as well. MI5 knew prosecutors lied to the press about Cyril Smith case, the inquiry was told. And I'll go through this quickly because we've got a lot of material today. But here's Andrew Parker quoted in these articles, giving the first public speech outside the UK by a serving head of MI5. Mr. Parker told an audience of security chiefs in Berlin that Europe faces sustained threats and sustained hostile activity from certain states. Let me be clear by this. I don't mean spies spying on other spies, spies following each other around at the dead of night. I mean the deliberate, targeted, malign activity intended to undermine our free, open and democratic societies. Now, this document is freely available on the internet. By its source data, it appears to be a genuine document which has come out of the ICSA inquiry. And this is one page of a letter from MI5 into the inquiry. We can blow this up on screen. You can freeze the screen to read what they're saying, but it's giving the detail around these dossiers and what information came into the hand of MI5. But the amazing bit down at the bottom is that when they said they didn't do anything, they said, well, our primary role was defence of the realm. So we've got politicians who were repeatedly abusing young boys. MI5 knew, they did nothing. And the reason they say in this letter, we take this to be genuine, is because of defence of the realm. Does this mean that they were defending child abuse in the realm, Mike?
I suspect I would read that as meaning that in order to defend the realm, they have to protect the operatives of the realm, being the politicians.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
So they covered it up.
David, I'll give you a comment here. I've got a couple of slides to add to this, but it's quite unbelievable that we have to take what British intelligence is pumping out through the media at the moment as if everything they say is true, when we can show very easily that the track record of both MI5 and MI6 is to lie to create wars, to lie to help protect child abusers.
I think that was an astonishing piece there of information you put forward. I was completely blown away by the dates. Eight boys accusing Cyril Smith, a credible case, able to be prosecuted, able to imprison him, 1970. So he was allowed to go on. He died in 2010. That's 40 years of abuse. 40 years. And they let it happen.
And they let it happen.
Yes, they let it happen.
Astonished. And here is Mr. Parker going on. Now he's really going for it. He's on to the Kremlin. He accused the Kremlin of flagrant breaches of international rules, citing the invasion of Crimea, attempts to interfere with democratic elections in the US and France, unleashing of cyber attacks, as well as the Salisbury episode. The truth is to sow doubt. By flat denials of the, sorry, the aim is to sow doubt by the flat denials of the truth, to dilute truth with falsehood, divert attention to fake stories, and do all they can to divide alliance. Barefaced lying seems to be the default mode, coupled with ridicule of critics. That's what he's throwing at the Russians, but this is the nature of his own organisation. And I'll just finish on this one. I was alerted to this freedom of information request that was put into ICSA, the Child Abuse Inquiry, asking to see documentation passed from MI5. This is the letter that Liz Long sent back. Now, we're very interested in Liz Long because she's the lady who appears to continually block any ability of child abuse whistleblower Melanie Shaw to get in front of the inquiry. But in this letter, she says, dear Mr. Church, thank you for contacting the inquiry via email on the 22nd of April. The inquiry aims to be as open and transparent about its work as possible. Accordingly, it will keep its website updated regularly with new information, as well as hearing transcripts and evidence during the public hearings project. However, as the inquiry is not a public authority to which the Freedom of Information Act 2000 applies, we are unable to consider your FOI request. Now, we have been told from an extremely accurate source that this information is simply not true, and it's not true on two accounts. The first one is as a publicly funded inquiry, ICSA, missing L there, falls under the FOI legislation. And two, as an organisation which is handling public material, such as a letter from MI5, it also falls under the FOI legislation. There's something incredibly dirty going on here. If we have British intelligence services protecting senior members of the government conducting criminal activity by the abuse of children, we've got criminal intelligence services. We shouldn't believe a word they say, even if it's pointing a finger at Russia.
OK, David, let's move to the Scottish Child Abuse Inquiry. And the Herald here, the headline is Child Abuse Inquiry announces 17 more institutions to be investigated.
Yes, this is very interesting indeed. So this is the official historic inquiry in Scotland run by Lady Smith on her own now. And the additional institutions are as follows: St Andrew's School in Shandon in Dumbartonshire, the Queen Victoria Boarding School in Dunblane, Balnacraig School in Perth, the Royal Blind School and Harmony School in Edinburgh, and also in Edinburgh, Donaldson School for Deaf Children, and Oakbank School in Aberdeen, and Ovenston Residential School in Fife, and Balrossie School in Inverclyde. Add to that, we have several other institutions, including Lennox Castle Hospital in Lennox Town. Now, this is an extremely interesting list. I would say a few things about some of these institutions. When it comes to Donaldson School for Deaf Children in Edinburgh, the Fresh Start Foundation have had reports of Satanist ritual abuse network operating in that institution. Lennox Castle Hospital in Lennox Town is consistently associated with reports of activities related to the MKUltra program and experiments on patients. And then we've got Queen Victoria School, which is perhaps the next slide you have.
Well, indeed. So that was the second school that you mentioned there in Dunblane. And the headline for the Scotsman is School with Dunblane Gunman Link, investigated by the Child Abuse Inquiry.
Now, let me explain this. So Dunblane School, it serves, this is Queen Victoria School in Dunblane. It serves the families of military families who are perhaps serving abroad. They report it's been linked to Thomas Hamilton, who killed 16 pupils and a teacher in Dunblane Primary School in 1996. Now, the view on the ground, the common knowledge within Dunblane, is that Thomas Hamilton had free run of Queen Victoria School.
Right.
So this brings.
David. This is an aspect of the whole Dunblane shooting, which really gets very little coverage. The fact that Thomas Hamilton appeared to be abusing children. He was running boys' clubs, and it seemed to have some connection to child abuse.
Yes, this has been ignored largely by official inquiries, and also this is a military school. This is the establishment school. It's not just any school, and he had free run. How? Why? How did that happen? I mean, this is a school that's visited by royalty. This is a school that's visited, that's receiving the children of high-ranking military officials.
Yeah.
And Thomas Hamilton had free run. So what this is going to do, if the Child Abuse Inquiry in Scotland is courageous enough, is it's going to start to bring out information about Dunblane. So we'll see.
You were shocked a moment ago about the fact that MI5 apparently had covered up the abuse of Cyril Smith in 1970, that he went on and continued to abuse for 40 years. The BBC has an article here, abusers should have been caught decades ago.
Yes, this is written by the very excellent Russell Finlay. So Russell Finlay, who's one of the best of Scottish journalists, who's writing here for the BBC. He's looking into this case. Now, the lady you see there, she's waived her right to anonymity, and she's speaking out very bravely in public about what happened to her. She was abused by an extremely vicious and brutal paedophile, who's also called David Scott, annoyingly. She found the courage, age 10, to tell what was happening to her. And what the response was it was worse than nothing, because although this person wasn't part of her family, it was a friend of the family, but it wasn't abuse within the family, she was nonetheless taken away from her family and into care. So her telling the truth only made her situation worse. So she's then fought on for decades. And this extremely evil man, and a serial abuser of many, many children, has finally been sentenced and convicted and sentenced. And the sentence is relatively light. And she's looking at this and she's thinking, well, that's not comparable to the sentence that I've gone through.
Yeah.
It's a very good piece by Russell Finlay. I've encouraged people to look it out and read it in full.
Okay, well, let's move on then. As we mentioned on Wednesday, the European Parliament voted in favour of the new copyright directive for the European Union. The result of that vote was 438 in favour, 226 against. And so the Copyright Directive now goes they go into discussions between the European Council, the European Commission and the European Parliament to negotiate the final text. But the key point is that there are two clauses in this, or two articles in this. Article 11, which is what's being described as a link tax, and Article 13, an upload filter. So the link tax creates a special copyright fee to be paid by any website that wants to link to the content produced by news publishers. So, for example, if you're a news aggregation website and you want to link to a headline, you'd be required to pay for that. Or if you wanted to link to a piece of text from, say, a Guardian article or a Telegraph article in your own article, and you wanted to quote from that article, you would have to pay for that as well. And the key problem with this for me was the fact that this is being described by the European Commission as an unalienable right. In other words, even if the Guardian or the Telegraph or the BBC wanted to waive this right, they would not be able to waive the right and stay within the law. So this is going to come, and it makes it very difficult for news producers that want to quote from other news producers. It's a form of going to produce a form of censorship, or at the very least, it's going to produce articles which are increasingly unsourced, and that, to my mind, makes that pretty dangerous. And the other thing, of course, is this sort of escalation of effectively YouTube's content ID system, Article 13, which is introducing automated filters for all users uploading content to internet platforms, that content would be automatically scanned and compared to, you know, copyright material, and simply would never appear in the first place. Now, of course, there's two issues with that. First of all, if you look at YouTube's content ID system, although it's a lot better than it used to be, the number of false positives are still huge. There are people out there that are claiming to own the copyright to material when they clearly don't own copyright to material. And there's no the appeals process, you're effectively presumed to be guilty. So it's pretty unpleasant situation if this then gets spread out across all platforms. But the other problem, of course, is, you know, what is material that's being uploaded to the internet going to be compared against? So this looks like another form of censorship as well. Now, what interested me, and I've got to say thank you to Duncan for the tip-off on this, was that it was, you know, one of the main sort of campaigners in favour of, particularly Article 13, was the Performing Rights Society that manages rights for musicians. They were very keen to see this, but I'm not certain that this new legislation is going to solve anything for them. Well, in the meantime, yesterday, Lucy Powell, MP from the Labour Party, introduced the Online Forums Bill. Now, this is a private members' bill, so the chances of it actually passing are very, very slim. The vast majority of private members' bills, unless they manage to get government backing, won't get very far at all. So it's unlikely this is going to get very far, but it shows intent, and that's why I'm raising it. So this is the Online Forums Bill, which she says she wants to hold administrators, owners, moderators, people that run their own internet forums, they want to be held to account or responsible for any, what she describes as hate speech or defamation, which may appear on forums. You know, this is a very significant, this would be a very significant change in the law, because at present, it's the person who posts to the forum that has to take responsibility for their own post. She's particularly complaining about secret private groups on Facebook. You know, no aspect of a Facebook secret group is searchable or visible to non-members. So there can be all kinds of defamation, all kinds of hate speech going on there, and nobody would be any the wiser. So she needs to she wants the padlock taken off that, and for these groups to be shut down, and for Facebook to ban any private groups at all. And she's saying, as I say, that any open groups on Facebook or on any other internet forum hosting racist, Islamophobic and anti-Semitic content would be dealt with by making sure that moderators become legally liable for the content. This is what she had to say. Online platforms such as Facebook allow users to create private groups for any purpose. Investigators have found groups replete with criminality, hate speech run by radicals seeking to evangelize others. So this isn't just about hate speech. This is about so-called radicals evangelizing others, and it's very, very broad. Just 2 seconds, David, any thoughts on this?
It's coming into the realm of preventing free speech, and this idea of hate speech. Hate speech is a concept to shut down speech you don't like. You know, this is we're not going to argue with people. We're not going to put forward a case. We're not going to explain why they're wrong. We're not going to rely on our ideas being better. We're just going to criminalize you, and then we'll lock you up. and we'll use the state, we'll use the power of the state to control the control the debate. I feel very uneasy about all of this.
Well, of course, and individuals being criminalised but not being criminalised are the intelligence services. So let's come back to them again. And a bit of a success for Big Brother Watch, because they have been challenging the Investigatory Powers Act, and they've been doing it very successfully, both in the UK courts, but now also in the European Court of Human Rights. So they lodged this action in at the European Court of Human Rights before the new Investigatory Powers regime, which came into force in the 2016 Investigatory Powers Act. So the judgment is about what was happening before. But remember, the 2016 Investigatory Powers Act was a pretty lame attempt by the British government to legalise illegal and unlawful activity from the previous legislation and previous years. Now, as I say, REPA has been replaced by EPA, but this gives plenty of opportunity for further action to be taken. So there was a Q&A session following, attached to the judgment, and this is what it had to say. Isn't it important that states are able to carry out secret surveillance in order to fight against terrorism? Now, of course, this action is all about the bulk collection of data and just trawling stuff off the internet. So anyway, their answer was, the court expressly recognised the severity of the threats currently facing many contracting states, including the scourge of global terrorism and other serious crimes such as drug trafficking, human trafficking, the sexual exploitation of children and cybercrime. It also recognised the advancements in technology have made it easier for terrorists and criminals to evade detection on the internet. It therefore held that states should enjoy a broad discretion in choosing how best to protect national security. Consequently, a state may operate a bulk interception regime if it considers that it's necessary in the interest of national security. That being said, the court could not ignore the fact that surveillance regimes have the potential to be abused with serious consequences for individual privacy. In order to minimise that risk, the court has previously identified six minimum safeguards which all interception regimes must have. So those six safeguards are that the national law must clearly indicate the nature of the offences which may give rise to an interception order, a definition of the categories of people liable to have their communications intercepted, a limit on the duration of interception, the procedure to be followed for examining, using and storing the data obtained, the precautions to be taken when communicating the data to other parties, and the circumstances in which intercepted data may be erased or destroyed. And of course, in this country at least, Brian, none of that is taking place.
None of it. And it's ongoing, Mike. So the surveillance system gets ever bigger. Controls over it are ever more lax, as with the government giving massive powers to GCHQ. The government didn't have the authority to do that.
Yeah. Right, David, we'll probably have to end on this one then. We want to talk about anti-Semitism briefly, so we'll start off with the BBC, unfortunately. Union leader suggests Israel created anti-Semitism row.
Indeed he does. He says, quote, "Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I'll tell you what. One of the best forms of trying to hide from the atrocities that you are committing is to go on the offensive and actually create a story that does not exist for people on this platform, the trade union movement, or, I have to say, for the leader of the Labour Party." So he's suggesting that Israel, it's a plot to detract from the negative attention that Israeli policy in Gaza and elsewhere is currently getting. So that's his theory. The next slide here, this is there's been people suggesting directly via the Labour Party complaints procedure that Jeremy Corbyn is guilty himself personally of anti-Semitism. They presented evidence that he was anti-Semitic that went back to 2008. The Labour Party committee has decided to drop its investigation, finding that the evidence didn't meet the required threshold. So read into that what you will. And then this last one here, this is a letter of resignation first published in the Huffington Post from Hannah Rose, president of the Union of Jewish Students. She writes that, quote, "I cannot in good faith continue as a member of a political party which has deliberately and recklessly allowed anti-Semitism to emerge and even more concerningly flourish. I cannot give support or succour to a party which its own MPs consider to be institutionally racist." And she concludes, "I will continue to fight for a just and equal society," by the way, I would point out that those things are incompatible, "a just and equal society where racism is challenged and no citizen is left behind. However, I now know that the Labour Party is not the place where this battle is fought. My Jewish values led me to join the Labour Party, and now my being Jewish leaves me no choice but to resign." So this played quite strongly and was viewed as further evidence that the Labour Party is indeed institutionally anti-Semitic. So that's the situation. And isn't it a strange one? Because what we're seeing here is a couple of themes, I think, working their way through. Firstly, the left wing in politics have used the shout of racist, anti-Semite, homophobe, Islamophobe to close down debate. Right? This has been the tactic for many, many years, that they don't examine the issues. They make looking at the issues, they make talking about the issues actually unsayable. It's a form of thought control, it's a form of political Marxism. It's a form of newspeak. They make talking about the issues unsayable. They make the people, paint the people who want to talk about the issues as so contagious that they cannot even be approached, that they are utterly beyond the pale. They generate disgust and hatred for people who might want to raise problems about immigration or about anything that the left don't want to talk about. As an attempt to make the only thinkable, sayable policy that is allowed into the public domain their policy. So it's a means of winning the argument without having the argument by attacking the opposition. This is cultural Marxism. This is what political correctness is all about. But lo and behold, here, having created this weapon, it's now turned on them. Right? It's now become an internal feud. Because you have the conflict between those who wish to stop criticism of Israel and of Jewish roles within British society, meeting the people who want to spend all of the time criticizing Israel. And they're both trying to use the same techniques to silence the opposition. And this war has broken out. It's a very strange sight to behold.
David, thank you for that. We need to do more on this analysis because, of course, we can see immense power being brought both into the Conservatives and Labour by Israel. That's openly declared in friends of both parties. But something is now backfiring, as you say. We started out with that important news on Nippy, thank you, being bullied at school. Let's end on some really high profile news on Corbyn, so it fits in with the segment at the moment. But we got Michael Crick from Channel 4, and he tweeted out, "Jeremy Corbyn outside his house this morning tells a BBC pool cameraman, 'Right, can you turn it off?' And he raises his hand towards the camera." So there's a little 40 second video clip simply showing Corbyn putting up his hand saying, "All right, can you stop filming?" Pretty normal reaction, but it's being spun into news. What I really loved is when you look at comments from the public, they see through this. "I respect you as a journalist, but please can you explain how on any level does this constitute news?" This is brilliant stuff because we're seeing more and more people clearly seeing through the fake news coming out of the mainstream global media corporations, which is a good thing. David, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you to our viewers and listeners today. We will be back at the same time on Monday. Bye-bye. Bye.